Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link on this Wednesday, the 21st of June. Coming to you live from Bonn, Germany, I'm Eunice Wanjiru and with me is...
Abubakar Jallo, co-hosting the show.
Coming up, UN agencies say that South Sudan's famine is over, but the situation remains dire.
Apparently, the rate of, people leaving the country is still high. I mean, those who are going to refugee camps, like to the neighboring countries.
It's difficult to end the crisis in South Sudan because those who apparently hold the key to the solution are directly benefiting from the chaos materially. That's the response from Daniel in Zimbabwe, and I will have more of those in the program.
And the UN accuses DRC authorities of backing a militia behind horrific attacks. What does this mean? We hear from an analyst.
The UN is in effect saying that there is a chance that it was the Congolese army that killed two UN investigators a couple of months ago.
Stay tuned to these stories and more coming up right after we hear what's been happening around the globe.
This is DW News with me, Jen Nyingi. At least 100 people have been killed in the Central African Republic after heavy fighting erupted hours after the government signed a peace deal with rebel groups. The agreement had been brokered by a Catholic group in Italy, and many were skeptical because such agreements had previously failed. Jacob Bomani with the details.
The local Catholic mission says the death toll could be higher because it has been too dangerous for Red Cross teams to recover bodies from the streets. Witnesses said the fighting erupted early Tuesday between the anti-Balaka militia and rebels from the group known as FPRC, who were once part of the Seleka movement. Central African Republic has faced fighting since 2013, when predominantly Muslim Seleka rebels seized power in Bonki. Anti-Balaka militias, mostly Christians, fought back, resulting in thousands of people killed.
In a shake-up in Saudi Arabia, King Salman bin Abdulaziz has named his son Mohammed bin Salman as the first in the line to the throne. The 31-year-old, however, retains his position as defense minister, a post he held when Riyadh joined a war in neighboring Yemen in 2015. Many Middle East analysts like Sakuz Abu Zaid say his appointment didn't come as a surprise.
At this point, it probably means more continuity than anything else. Because he's emerged as the most powerful figure within the kingdom over the past 2 years, because he's the main proponent and motivating force behind Saudi Vision 2030, because he's led this kind of re-engagement with the United States and, you know, was the driving force behind bringing Trump over for the Riyadh summit. You know, I think this all just means that we're going to see more of the same in terms of Saudi Arabia's quite, stern and aggressive posture against Iran and the region, its commitment to driving through these economic reforms.
Britain's Conservative Party has today outlined its legislative agenda, citing that the government's priority is to secure the best possible deal for Britain as it leaves the European Union. The government's legislative agenda was laid out today in the Queen's speech to Parliament. It had been scheduled for Monday, but was postponed because of political uncertainty.
My government's priority is to secure the best possible deal as the country leaves the European Union. My ministers are committed to working with Parliament, the devolved administrations, business and others to build the widest possible consensus on the country's future outside the European Union.
You are listening to DW News. An Al-Shabaab suicide bomber has killed 15 people and injured 9 others in Somali capital Mogadishu. Somalia's prime minister condemned the attack, claiming it killed civilians preparing for the Eid celebrations taking place early next week. The United Nations Security Council today unanimously backed a West African force to combat a militant group as well as arms, drug and human trafficking in the Sahel region. The vast arid region has in recent years become a breeding ground for jihadist groups, some linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State that European countries, particularly France, fear could threaten Europe if left unchecked. For more news and information, visit dw.com or download the DW app. My name is Jen Nyingi.
This is Africa Link with me, Eunice Wanjiru.
And I am Abubakar Jallo.
Now, three UN agencies and the government of South Sudan said today that South Sudan is no longer classified as suffering from famine, following an increase in humanitarian aid. But while the famine has eased, the reports still say that almost 2 million people are on the brink of starvation, and an estimated 6 million people, which is half the population, will face extreme food insecurity between June and July. Wake Simon Budu is our correspondent from Juba in South Sudan. We caught up with him and wanted to find out whether these reports reflect what is actually on the ground.
Somehow there is an improvement comparing it to how things were when the famine situation was declared. At the meantime, many South Sudanese on ground, including me, I really don't think so, because apparently the rate of, people leaving the country is still high. I mean, those who are going to refugee camps, like to the neighboring countries of Uganda and Sudan, especially these two countries. And this is simply because of hunger situation. People cannot afford food. Food prices are high because there is no food supplies in a way. The conflict disrupted. The only food that is coming is from Uganda, which is not enough, and the prices are too high. And apparently there's a wide outcry, across several parts of the country, even including the capital, Juba.
We are aware, or it is known, that international aid organizations have also been providing food to the people affected. But is this support enough?
I don't think it's enough. Because, let me say, the last time I have been to the northern part of the country, especially Unity State and the area where famine was declared. And when I was there, I spoke to people on ground, and basically what they are saying is that this food is brought, they're given sometimes once in a while. They will stay for like 2 months before being given another one, then the food is not enough. Although the aid agencies had really tried their level best, especially WFP and the other aid agencies, including UNICEF, in trying to improve the situation.
The famine that is said to be over is also said to be attributed mainly to the civil conflict raging in the country. Are there efforts from both factions to bring peace in the country?
There is really no active roundtable or talk between the government and the active rebel group of Dr. Riek Machar, which is fighting.
Wake Simon Budu.
And some of the responses that we have coming in on our Facebook page, DW Africa, and also on WhatsApp. Daniel from Zimbabwe said, it's difficult to end the crisis in South Sudan because those who apparently hold the key to the solution are directly benefiting from the chaos materially. There are reports to prove this. Sadly, this is not a mere South Sudan problem. It is a problem with Africa, the lack of selfless leaders.
And Christopher Muflam from USA is telling the South Sudanese to man up and build trust among themselves. You all love your country. Well, Abu, I'm sure we'll get more responses from this.
We do have a lot of responses.
Let's now head to the European continent, where Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has accused the USA of Russophobia. Lavrov also denounced new sanctions the United States announced against 38 people fighting with and supporting Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. His comments came a day after the Pentagon accused Russia of carrying out an unsafe intercept of a U.S. spy plane in international airspace over the Baltic Sea Day. Zipporah Nyambura with more.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov criticized what he described as Russophobia. I cannot express anything but regret regarding this Russophobic obsession from our American colleagues. It's beyond all bounds. Poroshenko cannot fulfill his obligations according to the agreements, but the sanctions are against Russia. There's a very complicated process underway in Syria, and only Russia and, of course, Assad's regime get the blame. The US-led coalition recently shot down a Syrian fighter jet and a drone from Iran. Russia backs the Assad regime in Syria. In response, it's threatened to treat coalition aircraft and drones as potential targets. It's raised fears of direct confrontation between the two superpowers. Trump is set to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin at the G20 summit in about 3 weeks' time. Until then, the blame game between the two superpowers is set to continue.
That was our DW correspondent. The UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad Al Hussein called for an independent international probe into hundreds of recent killings in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He pointed to accounts of pregnant women and toddlers hacked to death and accused the government of failing to protect its citizens. The violence raging in DRC's central Kasai region has claimed the lives of more than 3,300 people since October last year, according to the diplomatic mission of the Catholic Church. So to follow up on this, I spoke to Phil Clark of SOAS in London, and I started by asking him whether there was any truth in this accusation.
The UN is accusing the Congolese government of a cover-up. The UN is, in effect, saying that there is a chance that it was the Congolese army that killed two UN investigators a couple of months ago. The government has always claimed that it was local militias that murdered the investigators, but there are many suspicions in the international community that in fact it's Kabila's government that was responsible for this. The UN has been waiting on the Congolese government to conduct a thorough investigation into the murder of the two investigators. That investigation so far has not happened.
So what action can the UN take on the DRC government?
The UN, unfortunately, doesn't have an enormous amount of leverage here in that the UN and various member states have already imposed sanctions on high-ranking Congolese government officials. Those sanctions have now been in place for many months and don't seem to be having a much impact on changing the political environment in Congo. And they certainly haven't been hurrying the government towards elections, which have now been delayed for nearly an entire year. So the UN knows that its only real solution here is to try to put more diplomatic pressure on the Congolese government.
There's still an ongoing conflict between DRC's government troops and armed troops. And the intervention by the government was perceived as manipulation designed to tighten its control over the Kasai region. Can we say this is the case?
The situation in the Kasai provinces is becoming increasingly violent and volatile by the day. This was always one of the more peaceful and more stable parts of Congo, but in the last 12 months, it's become a hotbed of opposition to Kabila's government. And because of that opposition, we've seen the rise of various militia groups. In response to those militias and the atrocities that they've been committing, there's been a very severe government crackdown, and the Congolese government has built a new militarized zone right across the Kasais. So the civilian population is caught between the militias on the one hand and the Congolese army on the other. The situation in the Kasais is escalating by the day, and the great danger is that it will spark further violence, not just in this part of Congo, but in several other neighbouring provinces as well.
I was speaking to Phil Clark of SOAS at the University of London.
And now some more responses to our top story, that is the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. We hear from Biron Gwazi from Zimbabwe, who had this comment.
On that conflict that is happening in South Sudan and hunger that is happening in South Sudan, someone is benefiting out of it some way. So that's the problem that we have right now in Africa. I think the solution that we can have is until the African people begin to believe in their own democracy, in democracy and elections, where they can avoid such situations. Because people are dying and are suffering because of some people's selfish reasons. Because how can you want the people that you want to rule to die before you rule because of your selfish reasons, because of the political crisis that you create in a nation? So I think the problem that we have right now is that is common in Africa, where people, they don't care about people who vote for them.
And that was Biron Gwazi from Zimbabwe. Hayford from Ghana said, I will put the blame on the government. And Abdul Aziz from... also from Ghana said, I'm sorry to say this, yet it's the truth. People of South Sudan are presently not matured enough to govern themselves. Those are some of the responses.
Keep it Africa Link. You're listening to Africa Link with me, Eunice Njiro.
And I am Abubakar Jallo.
Still to come, Cameroonians are asking for compensation 8 months after the deadly train crash.
We need technical equipment. I have expressed our essential need, which is a generator to power especially the mortuary, and our laboratory needs to be furnished.
And in the Central African Republic, the number of people killed in clashes since Tuesday has reached 100. I will bring your comments and responses shortly.
And we'll get to hear about what people are looking for in metal detector treasure hunting. It's been 8 months since the deadly train crash in Cameroon's town of Eseka that killed 80 people and left 600 injured. The small town at the center of the country is still struggling to come to terms with the trauma and the effects of the crash. The wreckage still remains unattended to. Many are yet to be compensated. And according to a correspondent in Cameroon, Moki Kinzeka, the residents not only feel abandoned but are also struggling to resume to their normal lives.
An intercity train meanders through the wreckage of a sister train that crashed here at Eseka. Most residents say life has not been the same. Mpele Emmanuel is one of them.
It was on October 21, 2016. We were removing wounded people from here and taking them to the hospital. Some were dying there at the hospital. There were deaths. And since then, this area has been forgotten. It has no even a single tarred road. I'm praying that the government should remember our locality. Previously, many trains passed here every day, but today only two pass here. Before the accident, we had six trains a day.
It's not just the economic loss. The Eseka District Hospital say they run out of equipment and medication. The hospital had to use its little human and material resources to treat over 600 wounded people and its 12 corpse capacity mortuary to conserve the bodies of 70 of the 80 people who died. Let's hear from the chief medical officer, Dr. Eric Ngele.
On a besoin d'avoir un certain.
We need technical equipment. I have expressed our essential need, which is a generator to power especially the mortuary, and our laboratory needs to be furnished. We have expressed the need to be provided with an ambulance, but as you know, you have to be very patient with our government.
Some of the victims, like Sadu Jemen, are still waiting for compensation or any assistance. Sadu lost her two legs.
God saved my life that day. I found myself on the ground with people lying on me. I thought it was finished. I have learned to forgive everyone on the spot. I no longer keep grudges against anyone.
Officials of the rail company visited the locality 8 months after the crash, led by its chair, Abubakar Abo.
I would first of all wish that we stand up and observe a minute of silence for our brothers, sisters and compatriots who lost their lives here at Eseka. We are all victims of the accident.
That report was compiled by Moki Kinzeka.
And some of the responses to this story is that of anger from so many people. Ichechikara Abba from Nigeria said the pace at which such things are attended to is terrible around here. God help those people.
And Martha from Cameroon is saying what your correspondent said is very true. Cameroon has very bad system of government. The youth are suffering and the poor are dying in poverty, while the top government officials are enjoying from my words. That village is unknown in Cameroon until that accident.
And Felix from Tamale, Ghana said it is a terrible disaster which also had negative impact on Cameroon's infrastructure. Meanwhile, political post-colonial issues still divide this beautiful country.
On the spot.
Now, although the Gambia is the smallest nation in West Africa, it accounts for a high proportion of the migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. It has fewer than 2 million inhabitants, but last year alone, it accounted for more than 12,000 of the migrants coming from Africa. Earlier this year, however, 22 years of dictatorship came to an end, with a change in government bringing hope, especially to young people. But not everyone is convinced that things will improve. Our reporter Adrian Krish visited Bambali, a village with hardly any young men. Zipporah Nyambura presents his report.
Class has started and these students are eager to learn despite temperatures in the 40s. There's neither air conditioning here nor a fan. In fact, there's no electricity at the school. But that does not stop Ibrahima Daboy. The 26-year-old teacher loves his job and his country. He has no intention of leaving, despite most of his friends having left to seek their fortunes in Europe.
All my friends are gone, but they put it in me to go, but I'm not sure it's a very good way to go because I have my job here. You know, it's a noble profession, and I can help my own people so that they'll become tomorrow. And then in the future, if they become something, you know, that will minimize the people going to the back way.
The back way, they call it here in Gambia, meaning the dangerous journey taken by Gambians to get to Europe. The village elder has called for a meeting. Many here find it important to send one of the family members to work abroad, despite the risks involved. The villagers reckon in the last 10 years, one in every five residents has found his or her way to Europe.
In Bambali, we only have water
and lands. We can only engage in agriculture.
We use our earnings to send our people to Europe. That's how it works.
The government doesn't have a clue what's going on here. How can there be any development? Who wants his child to die on a boat? It's hard circumstances that push people to leave.
However, earlier this year, there was a democratic change of power in Gambia. After 22 years in office, autocrat president Yahya Jammeh was surprisingly sent packing. Adama Barrow took over the presidency, and there has been a ray of hope ever since. Information Minister Deba Jawa understands very well the great expectations of young people who played a crucial role in the political change in Gambia. He knows they are waiting to get jobs, but is asking them to be patient.
With the big challenges that are confronting this government, you know, 22 years of dictatorship, it's extremely difficult to undo that within a very short period of time.
Teacher Ibrahima Daboy earns just 100 euros per month. That's not enough to support his mother. One of his brothers has just arrived in Italy after crossing through the Mediterranean. His mother hopes that very soon he will start sending her money, although Ibrahima would rather that his brother remained at home.
You know, being in a democratic rule, you know, that's what Gambians like. That's why people like me don't want to go.
Ibrahima Daboy hopes the village gets more support from the government. Electricity and perhaps computers for the schools will be a good start.
That report was written by Adrian Krish.
Living Planet Africa.
Have you ever been out and about and seen someone walking around holding a metal detector? Well, you might need to go to South Africa. Metal detector treasure hunting has become popular in the country. It's a modern-day treasure hunt in a way, but it also leaves you wondering, what do they actually find? In our final report for today, Kerstin Velter takes us to the beaches of South Africa and inside the treasure chest of two dedicated detectors.
It's 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning, just before dawn at Muizenberg Beach, the most popular beach for surfers around Cape Town. But it'll take at least another hour until the first of them make an appearance. And that's exactly what these two gentlemen want. The beach for themselves.
I'm Yannick van die Kerk from Cape Town, South Africa. I'm working at Correctional Service. This is only a hobby. Metal detecting is my hobby. I like it. And it's nice to find things on the beach.
Okay, my name is Hank. Been doing metal detecting for about a year now with Henny. We hunt as a duo partner. He does the water scene. I do the beach. Yeah, let's get going. Let's see what's happening.
Today, the beach is quiet and serene while Henny and Hank start their hunt. That's what they call a sweeping movement with their metal detectors just above the sand. while listening intently to the sounds of the machines.
That means the ground balance is fine, and then you can start detecting. Okay. You start learning the different sounds your machine gives, and also you use your screen to try and judge what it is. When you're small, you want to find treasure, so this is the best way and easiest way to find treasure. For me, it didn't take very long. I found one or two coins in the ground, and I was hooked. There we go. Five rand coin.
Wow, 5 rand.
Well, it's not much, but it adds up. If you find 10 of these, you have 50 rand. So yeah, it buys for the beer at the end of the day.
Henny is 59, Afrikaans like Hank. The two share a passion for history and things lost long ago, which tell stories from the past.
Have you found something?
Just a foreign coin.
Do you have any things when you say, oh, if I find this as a first find, it's always good luck?
No, I just go all out for everything.
What was the most valuable thing that you ever found?
I pick up a men's ring, 18 karat gold. I keep it in a display case at home. In 3 years, I pick up 25 gold rings. All the rings is about 180 rings.
2 hours into their hunt today, Henny has only found worthless stuff. Some metal detectors sell their finds. Henny and Hank don't. If asked nicely, they help in finding lost items, or they advertise rings with engravings on Facebook to find the rightful owners.
We don't really do it for money. It's pleasure because, I mean, who doesn't want to be on the beach at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday?
I know quite a lot of people who wouldn't want to do that.
It's much better than sitting at home. That's the point.
Metal detecting has picked up a lot over the last 3 years in South Africa, from 40 to 4,000 hunters, says Henny. As he tells me this, Hank suddenly starts waving frantically at us. He's found something.
Ah, yes, boy! Congratulations!
It's a ring. It looks to be silver. There's a stamp. There's a big stamp. Cleo Blue 56. That's either a name or a jewelry brand or something, but it looks like silver.
Nice.
It's quite unusual. It's half a ring and half a bracelet. It's exactly the range for silver.
And my machine also high tone. Very, very nice tone.
Pushed by this valuable find, Hank and Henny continue scanning the beach, each a cigarette dangling from the corners of their mouths, challenging each other. But without jealousy, they're a team.
Kerstin Welter reporting.
And now to the main story on this second half of the show, that is the deteriorating situation in Central African Republic, where up to 100 people have died in clashes. A young blaze in Cameroon had this response.
What we see in the CAR is as a result of the lack of knowledge in the parts of those that are fighting. I think the greatest problem that we have in Africa and in the various areas that we've had conflict is people have not understood that bloodshed and fighting, killing each other, does not bring peace, but it instead escalates the conflict or the argument that we have, and the end result is never profitable to either of the parties.
And also to the same story, a regular contributor on this program, Isaac Godwin, Monrovia, Liberia, also had this response.
Although it has not been specified who what caused the clash or who is responsible for the clash, is either the rebels or the town dissatisfaction concerning government treatment towards them. So for that reason, I don't think that we can see anything as of now. But for the fact that most time we see government and rebels sign deals, most of the deals don't go down well, because it ends up that the government do not sometimes fulfill to the promise to the rebels. So it might also be the cause for this sort of clash, but also there might also be a conflict between the inmate villages or their dissatisfaction concerning how government run the affairs of the state.
We also have some comments on our Facebook page. Akapasar Sar said, Central Africa, you people are too late. It's time to develop. It's time to get education. It's time to get help, not fighting, killing each other.
I wish they listened to this information. Final message is from Tugba Wanda said, why Africa? Why? And John Waters said, oh my God, help us.
That does it for today's edition of Africa Link. Join us again same time tomorrow. I'm Eunice Wanjiru.
And I'm Abubakar Jallo.
Bye and take care.